Welcome to the Perry Johnson Registrars Podcast, where you can expect the latest news and discussions related to the management systems certification industry. Today's episode is a previously recorded webinar. If you would like to tune in to our upcoming webinars, visit our website at www.pjr.com/webinar or give us a follow on your favorite podcast app. Thank you for tuning in.
Good morning, everyone, and welcome to today's webinar, Root Cause Analysis and Systemic Corrective Action. My name is Shannon Craddock, and I'm the Programs and Accreditations Manager at Perry Johnson Registrars. So today we're going to be talking about why we selected this particular topic, why it's so important. We'll then talk about a well-written audit finding, which really sets the stage for good problem solving. We'll talk about corrections or actions taken to correct the finding. We'll talk about sound root cause analysis, specifically focusing on one technique, the Y technique. We'll talk about actions taken to prevent recurrence or corrective actions. Actions taken to prevent occurrence in the first place or preventive actions, and then good sound verification activities. So why are we doing this? Why this topic? Well, we want your organization to improve. And I'm a firm believer that there should be a strong correlation between third-party audit performance, how you do on your audits, how you respond to corrective actions. Are those corrective actions accepted first time through? And how you're performing in the eyes of your customers. And if you're doing well on your audits and you're answering any cited nonconformities with good problem solving, that really should drive improvement in the eyes of your customers, specifically your on-quality, on-time performance. Remember that the purpose of a management systems audit isn't to convince the auditor to write as few findings as possible, but it's to take systemic corrective action for each and every nonconformity that's documented. And when you do this, when you're doing good problem solving, really understanding the root cause and implementing a systemic corrective action, that's where we will see the stronger correlation. So let's move to discuss the audit finding. An audit finding should have three distinct parts: the statement of nonconformity, objective evidence, and a citation of the requirement that's not being met. So audit findings that don't contain these three parts shouldn't be written by PJR auditors. All of our auditors have been trained to write finding this way. And most importantly, this shouldn't be accepted by you, our valued clients. PJR clients should, in fact, reject audit findings that don't contain these three parts at the closing meeting. You're empowered here, folks. Feel free to reject the finding and ask the auditor to rewrite it. From time to time, we may cite opportunities for improvement. These exist only as statements or recommendations. They only have one part. There's no citation of a requirement not being met, because if there was a requirement to cite, a requirement that was not being fulfilled, it would be a nonconformity. Let's talk about some common pitfalls with the statement of nonconformity. So often we see that the nonconformity recorded is not the problem, but a symptom of the problem. So it's important that we express the issue in terms of the system. If the problem is expressed in terms of a person or incident, it's at the symptom stage, and we want to avoid that. I see both internal and third-party auditors making this mistake. It's important to get to the true problem, the systemic issue, or the problem-solving efforts will not be effective. Fixing symptoms will not stop the issue from recurring. So I always take this point in the presentation to kind of share a very simple analogy we can all relate to. So let's say you're not feeling well and your symptoms are a fever, a sore throat, maybe some body aches and pains. Now you may take some Aleve or Motrin or Tylenol, and that may address your symptoms. They can bring your fever down, maybe give you some relief from the body aches and pains and the sore throat. But if you have a strep throat infection, all the Tylenol in the world isn't going to kill those bacteria. So it's not going to stop the strep throat infection. We're only treating the symptoms of the problem if we're taking Tylenol. Additionally, a well-written nonconformity should stand the test of time. Your organization should be able to look back at nonconformities written years ago and understand exactly what the problem was. And if you're using those three parts of the nonconformity, we've been talking about the statement of nonconformity and copious amounts of detailed objective evidence, as well as a clear citation of the requirement not being met, the nonconformity will stand the test of time. So let's look at some poorly written findings and understand how we can make them better. So example one, there was no training matrix for the first shift operator running job 9954 indicating competence to run that job. This is expressed in terms of a symptom and not the true systemic issue. We're confusing objective evidence with the statement of nonconformity. This is in terms of a very particular person or incident, the first shift operator running job 9954. A better way to write this: the system for recording employee training and competence is not completely effective. And then the objective evidence to support that: there was no training matrix for the first shift operator running job 9954 indicating competence to run that job. And then a citation of the requirement, in this case, ISO 9001:2015-72D. You'll note that we're not just putting 7.2, we're carrying it out as far as we can to the letter suffix. You want to cite the most specific requirement possible. So the better way to write this finding is the system for recording employee training and competence is not completely effective. In fact, we're using the word system right in the statement itself. Again, focusing on the systemic issue and not a particular person or incident. Example two of a poorly written finding. Quality auditor in the blue cell was using an uncontrolled form to record the results of first piece inspection. Again, this is at the symptom level, not the systemic level. Again, we're confusing objective evidence with the statement of nonconformity. We're relating it to a very specific person, quality auditor in the blue cell, and a very specific incident. That one time he was using an uncontrolled form for first piece inspection. Let's look at a better way to write this finding. The document control system is not completely effective. Again, we're using that word system right in the statement itself, supported by very clear detailed objective evidence. The quality auditor in the blue cell was using an uncontrolled form to record the results of first piece inspection. And a citation of the requirement not being met, 9001:2015-7531A. Again, taking it as far out to the letter suffix as possible. So again, a well-written finding, the document control system is not completely effective. Here, the statement of nonconformity focuses on the systemic issue. We're not focusing on a particular person, quality auditor in the blue cell, or a specific incident, the fact that they were using an uncontrolled form in the statement of nonconformity. So when you review a statement of nonconformity written by a member of your internal audit team, a PGR auditor, or even your customer, you want to ask, have they distinguished between the symptoms and the real systemic issue? And does our final statement of nonconformity focus on that systemic issue? Of course, are there detailed data, the objective evidence, and the citation of the requirement not being met to assist in understanding the breadth and depth of the finding? PGR has an internal document. It's our Advisory 3, requiring all auditors to document any non-fulfillment of a requirement as such. So if something is non-conforming, it needs to be written as a non-conformity. In fact, we tell our auditors it's absolutely inexcusable not to do so. There's no benefit to the auditee. All you're going to do is fix the symptoms of the problem. If we don't write it up as a true finding, you aren't going to analyze the root cause and implement systemic corrective action. You're not going to get better. Your system isn't going to improve. Your performance in the eyes of your customer isn't going to improve. And really, big picture, this contributes to the diminishment of the integrity of accredited management system certification. So it's our expectation that all nonconformities that exist need to be written by PGR auditors, and they need to be written as previously described with the three parts: statement of finding, objective evidence, and a citation of the requirement not being met. Okay, let's move on to corrections or actions taken to correct. These are actions taken with respect to the symptoms or incidents. So they're incident-specific actions. These are very important and should be taken as quickly as possible to stop symptoms, stop the bleeding. So if you have that strep throat infection, you want to take the Tylenol as soon as possible to alleviate your symptoms and discomfort. Corrections typically take two forms. One could be we calibrated the gauge, we controlled the uncontrolled form, we took the Tylenol to bring down our fever, or adding a layer of inspection to catch any future occurrence of the issue. But remember, inspection adds cost to the system, not value. Later, we'll learn that once corrective action is implemented, that costly added layer of inspection should be able to be removed from your system. Now, if you're shipping non-conforming parts to your customer, part of your containment may be using a third-party containment organization to sort and certify your product. That's meant to be a temporary measure until you figure out the root cause of the issue and implement a systemic corrective action. That third-party containment company is adding cost to the system. Containment actions or corrections should be very specific. So if we consider the two examples we've been following through this presentation, number one, the training matrix for the first shift operator running job 9954 was updated to reflect his competency to run the job unsupervised. Or all copies of the uncontrolled form the quality auditor in the blue cell was using were destroyed. So again, we're treating the particular symptom or incident with these incident-specific actions or corrections. Keep in mind that corrections also need to include an extent analysis. An extent analysis may also be referred to as a look across. So our auditor found one instance, one training matrix that wasn't up to date, one example of somebody using an uncontrolled form. But how many other times is this happening? What is the depth and breadth of the issue? So a PGR auditor may have uncovered one, two, three examples of the issue, a single gauge out of calibration, maybe a document that's uncontrolled or a training record that isn't updated. It's your job to figure out how many more are there. So a properly executed and written extent analysis might read like this. So in this particular issue, the auditor appears to have found two gauges, number 2458 and 1354, that might have been out of control. So they say, we verified the two gauges found by the PGR auditor. Both were conforming. Our extent analysis included the 213 other gauges in the facility. So I'm assuming then that there's 215 gauges. 213 the organization looked at, and the two found by the PGR auditor in the company. Only one, number 5858, was found to be out of calibration. It was calibrated and returned to service. No product was measured with this gauge since it was last in a known state of calibration. That's lucky. If product was measured with that gauge since it was in a last known state of calibration, you would need to look at what product was measured and possibly recall it. All of that is part of an extent analysis. Our nonconformity report form now includes a blank for extent analysis. Now you can use your own nonconformity report form, but if you don't have a blank for an extent analysis or you don't include an extent analysis as part of your correction, your response will get rejected. Okay, let's move to root cause analysis. And one of the most common pitfalls with root cause analysis is simply restating the incident for the root cause. This is not acceptable, and it will result in a rejection of your corrective action response. So examples of this would be, our organization failed to update the training matrix for the operator running job 9954. Yes. We know that. We told you that when we wrote the finding. You're not telling us why your organization failed to update the training matrix. The quality auditor in the blue cell didn't use the correct form to record the results of first article inspection. Yes, thank you. But again, we do know already know that. We told you that when we wrote the finding. You need to tell us why. Another common pitfall is that many cars give corrections or containment actions for the root cause. This is also not acceptable. Okay, so if you're looking at Instagram or checking your email, tune back in. This is the single most important slide in today's presentation. A good root cause analysis answers this question. What in the system failed such that the problem occurred? I'm actually going to repeat that. What in the system failed such that the problem occurred? Again, they're trying to get you to fix the systemic issue, not just take Tylenol to alleviate the sore throat pain and bring down your fever, fixing the system. Again, the focus is on the system, not the incident. Folks, it's possible that some problems may have multiple root causes. Or several possible root causes. And if you're not sure what the true root cause is, you'll have to take corrective action for every possible root cause. If the root cause has been found, the problem can be turned on and off, just like a light switch. If the problem cannot be turned on and off at will, then the root cause has probably not been found. Previously, I worked managing systems for a large tier one automotive supplier. We had a big problem with mixing left-hand and right-hand parts and shipping right-hand parts in left-hand boxes, vice versa, to General Motors. We thought we discovered the root cause, which was the configuration of the manufacturing cell and the pack-out boxes. So we moved the cell around, and that was our corrective action, but we were still shipping left-hand parts and right-hand boxes. So we knew we didn't have the true root cause. We did some additional problem solving, brought in some more team members, and we had a comment from a third shift material handler who said, you know, if it was impossible to put a left-hand part in a right-hand box and vice versa, you couldn't mix the hands. So we reconfigured the pack-out boxes, added new inserts, and we could turn the problem off just like a light switch. We never had an issue again. And when we, in a controlled environment, reintroduced the old pack-out boxes, we again found we were mixing parts. We turned the problem back on. We knew we had the true root cause. Now, there are a lot of different techniques for root cause analysis. Is not the Ishikawa diagram or fishbone. Today, I'm going to talk about the 5-Y technique, or the Y technique, because sometimes it may take more than 5 whys to get there. So let's take a look at the first finding we've been following through this presentation. The system for recording employee training and competence is not completely effective. Supported by the objective evidence, there was no training matrix for the first shift operator running job 9954. Indicating competence to run that job. So why was there no training matrix? The first shift supervisor failed to update the training matrix as required by the first of the month. Well, why did the first shift supervisor fail to update the matrix? Well, before the end of the prior month, the HR manager would email the training matrix template to all of the department supervisors. But this didn't happen this particular month. Well, why not? The HR manager left the company before the end of the month and her replacement didn't email the template to all the supervisors. Well, why didn't the new HR manager email the template? Well, the procedure for training didn't include a requirement to prompt the new HR manager to email the template to all the supervisors. So you'll note here that I've been asking why over and over again. And in this case, we felt we got to the root cause in 4 whys. Let's take a look at another example. The second scenario we've been following through this presentation, the document control system is not completely effective. The quality auditor in the blue cell was using an uncontrolled form to record the results of first piece inspection. Well, why were they using an uncontrolled form? Well, all the controlled hard copies of the form had been used in the blue cell, so the quality auditor resorted to an uncontrolled form. Well, why did they resort to an uncontrolled version of the form? The quality auditor in the blue cell was not aware that when no hard copies of a particular form were available, the latest version of the form could be printed from the company's database. Well, why didn't they do that? The quality auditor was not given a username and password to access the database. Well, why not? HR didn't have a policy to ensure that all new hires are granted a system username and password. So some things we will not accept for root cause: oversight. We don't accept oversight. We misunderstood the requirement. I may accept this on a first audit or a transition audit to a new version of the standard. As you're implementing a new set of requirements, you may not understand the requirement. And then in the audit, the light bulb goes off for you. And the way the auditor explains it or asks a question makes the intent of the requirement clear. I forgot, and some of my personal favorites, another ISO 9001 blunder where our consultant messed up, or human error. So I want to pause before I get into corrective actions and chat for a bit about how do you know you've gone far enough asking why over and over again? In the prior examples, we got to 4 whys and we stopped. And it's difficult to know for sure, have you gone far enough? What are some keys for success? Number one, it shouldn't be just a single individual doing the 5-why analysis themselves. You should have people from multiple disciplines, multiple departments participating in the problem-solving process. You'll remember in the example that I shared, it was a third shift material handler who said, you know, if it was impossible to put a left-hand part in a right-hand box, you guys wouldn't be mixing hands and shipping mislabeled parts to General Motors. And then there's a point when asking why over and over again, it just becomes a bit too repetitive. And it's just because you didn't have it, because it wasn't implemented. And I always analogize it to when my kids ask me why over and over again, and I finally say, because I'm the mom and I said so. When your problem-solving team gets to that point, the because I'm the mom and I said so point, you can have some degree of confidence, assuming you've got your multidisciplinary team, that you've gone far enough and can move to the corrective action stage. So corrective actions should address the root cause. They therefore should address that very important question, what in the system failed such that the problem occurred? A common pitfall that I see here is that many organizations will repeat their correction or containment instead of giving corrective actions. This is not acceptable. Not only should corrective actions address the system, they should also be irreversible and involve a change in the system. Retraining by itself is generally not a system change. Chances are you already trained people on the activity. How is retraining going to fix it? And remember that corrections are not irreversible. In the automotive industry, corrective actions should prompt changes to the design or process FEMA and control plan and may require a new PPAP. Because corrective actions address the root cause, there should be at least one corrective action for each root cause that's identified. And subsequent data should show that the problem has 100% disappeared. So when we were able to demonstrate that our corrective action of making it impossible put a left-hand part in a right-hand box. When that clearly demonstrated that the problem had 100% disappeared, then we knew, in fact, that we had the true root cause. Bear with me a moment, folks. I lost my slide. Because we were able to show subsequent data had showed that the problem had 100% disappeared. We were able to turn the problem off like a light switch. So let's look at the nonconformities that we've been following through this webinar. The system for recording employee training and competence is not completely effective. Does our corrective action address our root cause? Our corrective action states, Section 4.6 of the procedure for training was updated to include a requirement for the HR manager to email the training matrix template to all supervisors by the end of the month. The new HR manager was trained, and she added an automatic reminder to Outlook to perform this task. Does this corrective action address the root cause? Well, let's scroll back to our root cause. The procedure for training didn't include a requirement to prompt the new HR manager to email the template to all supervisors. And now our corrective action does include an update to that procedure for training. You'll note that there's a training event that went with this, but it's not the only thing because training is not irreversible, as we previously discussed. Take a look at our second example. The document control system is not completely effective. In this case, their corrective action was the new hire work instruction was revised to include a requirement to grant new hires a username and password for the company database is appropriate. HR personnel were trained on this change. Again, you're going to note that there is a training component to this corrective action, but it's not the only component. There's an irreversible component as well, a permanent system change to the new hire work instruction. But does that corrective action address the root cause? HR didn't have a policy to ensure all new hires were granted a system username and password. And now they do. The new hire work instruction was updated. It's always a good idea that when training is part of the corrective action response, this response should contain the technique that will be used to verify training effectiveness. Again, remember, you likely already trained people on something. How are you going to ensure that training this time is in fact more effective? Are you giving a test? Are you validating the effectiveness of the training? Are you making the training interactive so that people aren't just listening to a presentation? All right, moving on to preventive action. Preventive action answers one of two questions. What other systems exist that might have the same root cause present? Or what systems could I have had in place that would have prevented this from occurring? Common pitfall I see is in that many corrective action reports put corrective actions for preventive actions. Remember, though, that preventive actions address the future, not the past. What could still happen, not what did happen. Preventive actions address the system, not the incident. If there was a specific incident or symptom that's already occurring, you need a corrective action. Preventive actions really involve changing the system to prevent future problems from happening. Keep in mind, however, that preventive actions are not identified only because of nonconformities. Management system standards require a proactive process with inputs from multiple sources. Near miss reports, 5S programs, employee and customer suggestions, lean initiatives, walkthroughs, as ways or proactive processes to identify opportunities for preventive action. So in other words, no nonconformities should never mean no preventive. Okay, let's talk about verification activities, which are a very crucial and often misperformed step in the problem-solving process. And a lot of times I see corrective action forms that don't have places for verification at the appropriate locations. So in a sound verification activity, all of the following should be verified. Have containment actions or corrections been taken? Have you stopped the bleeding? Have you done a proper root cause analysis using a multidisciplinary team? You're able to turn your problem off and on again, just like a light switch. Possible systemic corrective actions have been implemented that address the root cause. Containment actions or corrections have been removed where appropriate, especially if they're that costly added layer of inspection. And that's because you've discovered the root cause and you've implemented a systemic corrective action to remove it. You don't need that third-party containment company costing you thousands of dollars a day doing sort and guarantee on your product. And as appropriate, preventive actions have been taken. Keep in mind that corrective actions, while meant to be irreversible, often are the opposite. They're often reversible. Because when you're changing a system, it means you're changing the way that work is performed, and change is difficult. Systems tend to return to where people are comfortable. Continue to verify actions even after you get positive results on the first verification. I often find that people are so anxious to close an issue on their corrective action log that they get a positive, they get one positive verification result, and they tend to close the action on their log as opposed to doing several verifications. I'd like to acknowledge that the IAOB provided some of today's slide content. I'll now open the floor to any questions or comments that you have and address as many of these as possible in the time remaining. Okay, I'm getting a question. Can you recommend any software tools to help manage corrective and preventive actions? There are a lot of software tools that you can use. I've audited a lot of organizations that use Plex, but there are a lot of other options that can be used. A quick Google search will reveal a lot of options. Somebody's asking, would human error be an acceptable answer? Probably an acceptable root cause if it was found out that the person willfully was not following the procedures. I think you would want to figure out why they were not willfully following a procedure and why they were still employed. I think that's more likely your root cause. Okay, another question. What approach would you recommend to influence stakeholders and leadership to properly conduct a root cause analysis, rather than simply skip to the answer, as opposed to investigating the problem to detect the real root cause? And I think the most effective strategy is to make sure that top leadership and stakeholders are part of the problem-solving team, as well as the people using the system. Somebody's asking if you can have a nonconformance associated with an undocumented but understood process. For example, make sure you have a budget to cover new hires before announcing a new position. A nonconformance can exist against a documented process or an undocumented process. Remember, the new versions of standards now have removed many requirements for documented procedures. So auditors have to audit and ask a lot of questions to understand what the implemented process is. So certainly a nonconformance can exist. Someone is asking, how does 5Y work when the problem is an employee is giving an inventory ticket to pull product and pulls the wrong product? Just like it would work in any other problem, why is it that they pulled the wrong product and it wasn't noticed? You need to understand how your system is allowing that. Again, convene a multidisciplinary problem-solving team and begin the process of asking why over and over again. Do all nonconformities require a root cause analysis? Yes, the standard requires that you do a root cause analysis unless your extent analysis truly proves and you can justify not doing so. Those are exceptionally rare cases, Janice. Francine, today's presentation does not include any interaction. It's simply lecture format. Emily, living good. I'm not understanding your question about Slack. If you could maybe chime in with a clarification. Someone's commenting that the turn on, turn off seems to be a simple and effective technique to solve problems. Again, I want to elaborate that on that. In order to turn the problem back on, you have to remove the corrective action and recreate the defect, make sure that the problem occurs again, and then implement the corrective action again and make sure that you've turned the problem off. Somebody's asking, what's a normal routine for training and retraining employees? So whenever you implement a training event, you want to make sure that you have a exam or validation at the end of the training to make sure that it's effective. Does the training really work? Another good technique is to make the training interactive and have the people participate in the training event as opposed to just listening to a lecture or an explanation of the process. Do you have to use specific tools to do corrective action and root cause analysis or create your own? If you're a PJR client, we provide our own corrective action form that has all the prompts that I've just described. You can certainly use your own and use the various headings that I've talked about today to make sure that the form is comprehensive. So the three prompts for the problem itself: correction, extent analysis, root cause, corrective action, and verification. Someone is again asking, can you describe the requirements on the extent analysis or look across? And remember that the purpose of an extent analysis is to find any other instances of the problem, any other symptoms, any other examples. So an auditor may find one uncalibrated gauge or one training record that's not updated, one purchase order that's not signed. It's not the auditor's job to find every instance. You need to find if there are any other examples as you do your look across. This includes looking at potentially every single gauge in your company, if that's the particular problem. Someone's saying, what would be the best way to write a proper nonconformity statement regarding the symptom of a machine crashing? So off the top of my head, it might be the system to ensure consistently functioning equipment, or the maintenance program, or the system to ensure properly maintained equipment is not completely effective. And the objective evidence would be machine ABC or machine XYZ keeps crashing. So again, you're getting problem solvers to focus on the provision of properly maintained equipment or the maintenance program. I need some clarification from Diana Kearns on what regulation states this is mandatory. I'm not sure what you mean, Diana. Somebody's talking about the very specific 8D problem solving technique. And the last step, congratulating the team. What are the best methods to do this? A lot of ways to effectively congratulate the team. Gift cards, accolades, recognition, employee parking spots, a lot of ways to do this depending on what matters in your organization and who the problem-solving team members are, what matters to them. How do you convince managers to not write off the symptoms and say that there's nothing we can do to stop the errors? I think that's indicative of a bigger problem in your organization. If people are saying there's nothing we can do to stop errors, Teresa, how is it that you have processes that allow errors to occur in the first place? Again, you want the focus to not be just on the symptoms, but on the systems that are allowing the symptoms to exist. Question on advice for identifying root causes when you suspect personality conflict is involved. We have a client who's unhappy with our employee's performance, despite our employee performing well against the requirements of the position. I'm guessing that your organization maybe places employees on customer sites. That employee is performing well against the written requirements of the position. But if there's a personality conflict, perhaps that employee is not the best match. There are a lot of unwritten requirements related to any position. And sometimes those requirements are unwritten because it's assumed that the employee will have them. And the corrective action might be putting another employee in that is a better personality match. We have many employees, many auditors who perform sound audits, but they may not be the best personality match for some of our certified organizations. And when this is the case, we have to remove those auditors from the situation. Someone's asking, what if a root cause corrective action requires significant investment to correct and management is not willing to invest against this nonconformance? Sometimes corrective actions are expensive, and you have to do a cost-benefit analysis to see if the most desirable corrective action is worth it. Or are you going to have to result to a more cost-effective corrective action that may not be as effective? So you have to do a cost-benefit analysis to see if the most desirable corrective action is the best approach. Getting some questions about whether you'll get copies of the slideshow. In the beginning, I mentioned that copies of the slides will be available for download from our website, www.pjr.com. So I did mention a few root causes that will not be acceptable, and that would be human error or oversight. Budgetary constraints. I don't necessarily know that budgetary constraints would be an acceptable root cause, but I'm well aware that budgetary constraints may affect the type of corrective action that you implement. And budgetary constraints may, for example, lead to a less than desirable or a non-ideal corrective action, and that may buy you some time. So for example, the best corrective action may involve procurement of capital equipment. Fully aware that that may not be the best solution or the most ideal solution for some organizations. They can't afford it. So you may implement other things, maybe continue to maintain the equipment that you have for as long as you can, but know that this may just buy you some time and that problem may continue to recur. So perhaps while it may be the most cost-effective solution in the short run, is it really the most cost-effective solution in the long run? What's the appropriate corrective action when the root cause is lack of management support? I certainly would expect that management is part of your problem solving team so that they know that they're contributing to the issue. If management isn't part of your problem solving team, that's a big indicator that they should be, and they should understand that they're contributing to the problem. A clarification on the name of the software program that I mentioned earlier in the presentation. I see a lot of organizations using a program called Plex, P-L-E-X, but there are countless other examples in the marketplace. Okay, someone is saying, I think human error is a root cause. People get distracted. They're off on that day. Mistakes happen. They're human. Retraining will do no good. I agree with that. Retraining will not do any good. Many people are doing repetitive jobs. If you have people doing repetitive jobs where errors could occur, you need to be thinking about implementing some mistake proofing into your process, so that people don't get distracted. Or if they do get distracted, the mistake proofing is going to catch that. Are you rotating people in and out of machines so they aren't getting caught up in a Groundhog Day scenario? And after a certain period of time on a machine, do you have a new operator cycling in? We've got about 5 minutes. I'm just scrolling through some of the questions to see what is most effective. Not understanding the question about a startup company, if the asker could provide clarification on that, that would be great. Is there any acceptability if an organization deems that the corrective actions are more expensive than the errors that are occurring, so they accept a certain amount of errors? This is interesting. So you can't, if you're not meeting a requirement, for example, you're not doing an internal audit or you're not doing your management review, you can't say that the corrective action is more expensive. This is only going to really become an issue or concern or consideration if it involves a corrective action that's truly more expensive, like purchasing new equipment. You may say, you know what? We can't afford to purchase new equipment. We can't afford to expand our building. We can't afford to implement error proofing. So we're going to accept that perhaps more maintenance on our equipment, or maybe cycling new operators in or adding some layers of inspection are going to be the extent of the corrective action that we can afford, knowing that it's not going to be 100%. You may be able to get away with that for a period of time, depending on what your customer requirements are and what your customers will tolerate. But it may be that you get repetitive errors, and implementing the more expensive corrective action in the first place might have been the better solution. PGR's problem-solving form, Janice, is given to you in the audit workbooks at the end of your audit. Today's presentation focused on the root cause technique, the why technique, or the five why technique to find the root cause. There are a lot of other techniques that you can use, and some might be more appropriate depending on the situation and depending on the tools your organization feels comfortable with. I almost consistently use, when I do my own problem solving with our teams here at Perry Johnson, the why technique. If you want to use a different technique, that's fine. Other problem-solving techniques were just not the focus of today's presentation. And one final question. Again, a comment on leadership and stakeholders being a hindrance to the problem-solving process. I think we've covered all the questions. Appreciate your time today as we come to the 12 o'clock hour. Again, a copy of today's slides will be available for download, as well as a recording of today's presentation from our website, www.pjr.com. And while you're there, please take a look at a list of future webinars and also copies of slides for webinars and other topics that are available for download. Have a great day. Waiting.